Now, as we get into the word tonight, we're going to continue following through Genesis as we're reading through the Old Testament as a church. If you haven't been doing that yourself, I would encourage you to jump in. We start the book of Exodus tomorrow. Be an easy place to jump in. Yeah, woo. Cheers for Exodus, you know. I love it. But we're going to be in Genesis 19 tonight. We're trying to fill in some gaps that are left from what Pastor Robbie doesn't cover on Sundays. And Genesis 19 is Sodom and Gomorrah. So if you're familiar with the story, you're probably like, really? Easter week, we're talking Sodom and Gomorrah. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense. But you'll understand why we went with this passage for tonight. If you're familiar with the story, you know this is rough. This is not a pretty story that we're studying tonight. So in all seriousness, just disclaimer, there's stuff we're talking about tonight that is going to make you squirm. And if you happen to be listening to this later on the podcast, don't listen to this one with your kids, okay? I want to get that out of the way to begin with. I don't want emails from that one. But let me give you the synopsis of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and then we'll go back and we'll work our way back towards it. We'll get a little bit of a runway to get us back there at the end of the night. So this is the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. It's an intense one. It's a fast-paced one. It's high stress, the whole story. So God has come down with two angels, two messengers. They've heard an outcry about what is going on in the city. So they're going to Sodom and Gomorrah to assess the situation. And if the situation is as they have heard, they're going to destroy the city. Not a great start to the story, right? But when they get there, there's a man named Lot who welcomes them into his home. And they're in the city. Well, as soon as he gets into their home, the rest of the town comes to his door and is pressuring him to bring the two men back out so that they can rape them. This is where I'm telling you, it's a rough story that we're talking about. So Lot, instead of sending those men back out there, he's pleading with the people not to do this. And what does he do? He offers up his two virgin daughters instead of these men. Again, this is rough. That's the decision he was made. But praise God, the angels stop that from happening. They don't let him do that. And they strike the townspeople with blindness. They stop what they're trying to do to break down his door. And what happens is he's telling this man Lot, hey, you need to get your family out of here because the city's about to be destroyed. And we don't want you to be part of it. So Lot goes, he's telling his family, he's scrambling, trying to get them all together to get them out of town. He tells his sons-in-law, they think he's joking, so they don't even leave. So he heads out with his wife and his two daughters. Along the way, as they're running, heading for the hills, his wife turns around for one last gaze at the city, and she turns into a pillar of salt. They were told not to turn around. I mean, she's all of a sudden a statue. She's gone. And at the end of the story, the cities are burned, and it only just keeps getting worse because at this point, Lot's two daughters, they don't have their soon-to-be husbands anymore, so they decide we still want to have children. They get their father drunk. They both sleep with him and both get pregnant by their father. This is a rough story, and it's a good place for us to be good Bible students. Okay, what do we do with all this? Like, where is God in the story? What is God allowing? What is just describing what happened here versus what does God actually approve of? We can't look at some of the things that happened in here and say, what, God's okay with that? No. So a lot of this is just describing what happened. So we're going to be good Bible students tonight as we study a really, really tough passage. And what I want you to see as we go through, we're going to back up a little bit in Genesis and work our way back to Sodom and Gomorrah. I want you to see that Sodom and Gomorrah is essentially a crescendo of things that we have already been seeing, these patterns that we've been seeing throughout Genesis. And one of the patterns that we're going to notice as we do that is that there is a problem when cities show up. We're going to discover the problem with cities that we see so far in Genesis. So this was a pattern that as I was studying for this, the Bible Project pointed out. And one of the things I was studying that they have, it's not throughout the whole Bible that cities are an issue, but at least up to this point in Genesis, when you see somebody entering a city, you know there's trouble ahead. So let's go back to the very beginning of Genesis, work our way back to Sodom and Gomorrah, and I want you to see some patterns that take place. So the first person we're going to go back to is Cain. So Adam and Eve, the first two people, they have two sons named Cain and Abel. Cain is the first person that we see involved in heinous sin. So he murders his brother. We got four people on the planet. One of them's a murderer. This is not a great start, right? And so God has found out about this. He has come down to assess the situation. He says to Cain, Genesis, this is chapter 4. I'm going to jump around a lot tonight, and I'm going to trust that you'll go back and read for yourself some. Genesis 4, verse 10, God speaking to Cain, he says, "What have you done? Your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground." So underline, highlight, whatever you got to do, cries out. That's a pattern we're going to see here. So God has come down. He's assessed the situation, and he's having a conversation with Cain, telling him what's about to happen. We're going to see that again. Cain is worried that people are going to find out what he's done, and they're going to return the favor with him. He's worried that if anybody finds him, knows what he's done, they're going to kill him. And God's actually gracious to him. If we jump down to verse 15, God replies to Cain. He's worried about somebody murdering him. He says, "In that case, whoever kills Cain will suffer vengeance seven times over." And he placed a mark on Cain so that whoever found him would not kill him. So he's very gracious. He protects him in that moment. Then Cain went out from the Lord's presence, and he lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Pay attention to that term, east, as we go. Cain was intimate with his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to Enoch. Then Cain became the builder of a city, and he named the city Enoch after his son. So we read this in 2026, and we think nothing of that. Like, this is great. Cain's an entrepreneur. He's going up and building up a civilization. What's the big deal? Well, the problem is, why is he building a city? In all likelihood, he's building this thing to protect himself. The problem with that is God has already offered his protection. There's no need for him to go build a city. You think if you drive downtown and you're going to Nashville, you don't actually know when you cross the line into downtown Nashville, into the city proper of Nashville, right? You don't know when you've entered in. But back then, you would have. So a city in this time implied walls. You got open land, and then you have a city surrounded by a wall. They gotta protect themselves. They're exposed to attack at all times. So they build a wall when they create a city. Again, the big deal is that Cain's trying to protect himself. He's taking things into his own hands when God's already offered him his protection. There's a lack of trust there. There's a mindset of trying to provide for himself in the construction of this city. The thing about the city is, y'all know this, cities develop reputations, right? They all have nicknames that we know. The city that Cain builds develops a reputation for murder. So Cain is a murderer. We find his great-great-grandson named Lamech. He's bragging about how murderous he is later in Genesis. That's the reputation this town has. Like, people know, man, that's where Cain's line lives. These are murderers. But then Lamech has a son named Noah. So the situation is bad. We go from Cain, and now we're into the flood. And I'm going to guess you're somewhat familiar with the flood story. Things are bad on the earth. And at the beginning of chapter 6, we read that seemingly divine beings are coming down to earth to sleep with human women and to produce offspring with them. So we have divinity coming down to humanity and trying to combine these two worlds. And this is the last straw for Yahweh, God. So God decides, he's come down, he's assessed the situation, and he's having a conversation with Noah. He says, "Hey, here's what's about to happen. Here's the plan. I want you to be in on it. I'm going to spare you and your family." But he's given him the assessment. He's given him a conversation. He's going to start over with Noah. Genesis 7, verse 16. I want you to see the protection that he offers him. "Those that entered the ark, male and female of every creature, entered just as God had commanded him. Then the Lord shut him in." So there's this picture there again. God is the one shutting them in. He's the one offering protection to the people. You got to notice that last phrase there. He takes the initiative on that. We're doing okay, right? Unfortunately, later in the story, again, it's the same cycle. If y'all are reading Genesis along with us, I hope there are times you're like, what is going on? Like, where is God in all this? Why do people continue messing up? And it's kind of confusing at times, right? Like, this is not, this is your first time reading through Genesis, you're probably like, wait, this is what Genesis is? There's all sorts of people messing up. What happens here? We see Noah's son Ham, something seemingly sexual happens here. Again, sex is a common theme where people screw up in all of this. We don't get the details of what happened, but it had to have been something in the sexual realm. So Ham's family line is cursed. Sounds a lot like Cain, right? What do we see from Ham's family line? He has a grandson named Nimrod. Here's what he does. He goes and builds a kingdom. His kingdom started with Babylon, Erech, Kana, a bunch of different names. From that land, he went to Assyria and built Nineveh and some other cities as well that become a kingdom. So through Ham's family line, he rebels against God. What does he go do? He goes and starts building cities that can have their own reputation, can have their own identity, two of which are Nineveh, where Jonah did not want to go take the gospel because of how evil the people were, and Babylon, who is constantly fighting against God's people. This is what happens when people rebel against God and go try to do their own thing. Babylon, that takes us into the next story, Genesis chapter 11, where we find the Tower of Babel. Now, Pastor Robbie spoke extensively about this a couple weeks ago. I'm not going to go into great detail here, but in short, we've seen at the beginning that before the flood, supernatural beings, they're coming down to human women. Now, we have humanity trying to build a tower to make a name for themselves to get up to the heavens. They're reversing that situation. What happens again? You guys can probably guess the pattern that's going to happen right here at this point. Genesis 11, verse 5. Then the Lord came down to look over the city. He's assessing the situation and the tower that the humans were building. So again, God assesses the situation. He has a conversation with other divine beings who are there in that moment with him, and he tells them the plan. And the plan is they're going to go down, they're going to confuse their language so that they cannot continue constructing this city. They destroy their plans. So why this pattern? What's the problem with cities? Are cities in and of themselves bad? No, we know that. But like we've said, cities develop an identity. All of them do. No matter what town you're from, it's got some sort of an identity, right? We know this because we give them nicknames. Las Vegas is the easy one to pick on. It's literally Sin City, right? Orlando is synonymous with Disney World. Nashville is country music. You think of the color orange when you think of Knoxville, right? Cities have an identity about them, and the people who live in them start to become part of that identity. And it's not just big towns. It's not just big cities, because this is no shot at Jason Aldean at all. I have no idea if he's a good person or not. But he has a song, right? Try that in a small town. Small towns have an identity too. I married into this. I'm from Knoxville. Rachel's from a little town in West Tennessee named Humboldt. Anybody? Humboldt? Really? There's a hand. This is great. Nobody ever actually responds to that. Humboldt's this little town, and man, do they have an identity. The first full week of May every year, I learned while we were dating, I'm going to be in Humboldt, Tennessee, because that's the week of the West Tennessee Strawberry Festival. That's what they do there. And I married into it, so that's what I do now. I'm part of this. This is, golly, should I say this or not? Rachel and her sister both were in the pageant world, okay? They were both the strawberry queen at one point. Rachel is the 69th annual West Tennessee Strawberry Festival hostess princess. That's her title, and she'll be so thrilled that I mentioned that. But now, your young adult's pastor is the MC for that pageant, which is a really surreal moment. I married into this small town, and I've become, part of my identity has become what this city is all about, right? This is what happens with it. Maybe it's not the same for you with a particular city, but it begs the question, what are you letting identify you? What tribe are you part of that gives you your identity that is something other than God? Maybe it's not a particular city. Maybe the first thing that comes to my mind is a political party, right? We can't set up camp in the Democratic or the Republican Party and let that be the city we live in that informs our beliefs, that tells us what to believe and why to believe it. We can't do that. We're followers of God. What do we see the people of God doing constantly? They are essentially nomadic. God says, I want you to live here for this time, and then I'm going to tell you where to go. You got to trust me to provide for you along the way. We're going to be moving around. We may settle for a time, but we are not the people that stick in one place and start to build our own protection, provide for ourselves. We trust God for all of those things. So when it comes to, for the example of a political party, man, you can't be so staunchly on one side or the other that when they start making the decisions that are against what a believer should do or believe, man, you can't just stay in that camp because you're one of them. No, you're one of God's. And we got to be willing to move in and out of those places. We cannot let them be the things informing who we are or why we should believe what we believe. We got to be people who can move around. We don't just settle in one camp or another. We get ourselves into lots of trouble when we let literal or proverbial cities tell us who we are. So that's how we get back to Sodom and Gomorrah. This is, I know it's a lot of lead up to the story that we're studying tonight, but I think it's important to see those patterns that are there of cities, of there being an outcry, of God assessing the situation, then having a conversation, telling somebody what's about to happen. It's no different in a lot of ways today. So we're focusing in on Genesis 18 and 19. We're going to cover essentially six chapters as we go. We started in 13. I'm going to summarize some things for you, and I'm going to trust and ask you to go back and read for yourself later, because it would take us a very long time if we studied all of this, if we read all of this. Here's how we get to Sodom and Gomorrah. Our boy Abraham, leading God's people. He has a nephew named Lot, who he takes in. Lot and Abraham have a lot of possessions. They have lots of people that work for them, and they have lots of cattle and herds. They're wearing out the land that they live in. So Abraham and Lot decide, hey, we got to separate. We can't both stay in the land, or we're going to wear out the land. Our herds are not going to have food, and our people are starting to get on each other's nerves. We need to separate so that we don't have a big conflict here. So Abraham lets Lot pick where he wants to go. He says, look out here, wherever you want to go, take the first pick, and I'll go wherever you don't go. And Lot picks where he wants to go in Genesis chapter 13. Verse 10. Lot looked out and saw that the entire plain of the Jordan, as far as Zoar, was well watered, everywhere like the Lord's garden in the land of Egypt. Little editorial note that the writer adds in here. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. Verse 11, so Lot chose the entire plain of the Jordan for himself. Then Lot journeyed, where? Eastward. That is typically, you've probably heard Pastor Rose say this before. Typically when somebody is moving eastward, it's a picture of them moving away from God. It's true here. And he moved eastward and they separated from each other. Abram lived in the land. He wasn't Abraham yet. Abram lived in the land. Notice where he lives. But Lot lived in the cities on the plain, and he set up his tent near Sodom. Verse 13, now the men of Sodom were evil, sinning immensely against the Lord. Now, if Lot had been paying attention to the story so far, if he had heard this sermon, he would have known, I need to avoid the cities, right? He would see this pattern that's happening. There's this foreshadowing there that's happening of how this story is going to go. So jumping forward a few chapters into chapter 18, we see where we started tonight. We see that God has come down. He's talking to Abraham, and he says, hey, there's an outcry against the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, and I'm here with my two other messengers to come assess the situation. So again, God is assessing the situation. He's having a conversation with Abraham, telling him, here's what's about to happen. What Abraham does is he pleads on behalf of the people. Before he starts pleading, chapter 18, verse 20. I want you to see these words again. Then the Lord said, the outcry, there's that phrase again, against Sodom and Gomorrah is immense, and their sin is extremely serious. I will go down to see if what they have done justifies the cry that has come up to me. If not, I'll find out. So he sends the two angels down to the city to check things out. When they leave, Abraham begins pleading with God to spare the city. He tells him, if you can find 50 people in the town, would you spare them? Would you not destroy the towns? He says, okay, he agrees to that. He works his way down to 45 and 40. Eventually, he gets down to 10. So for one, I think that tells us at times, if we're in a right heart about it, God's okay with you bargaining with him in some sense. I do at times. I assume he has the same attitude towards me he does Abraham here. But he gets down to 10. Says, if you can find 10 righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah, would you spare the city? Now, spoiler alert, we know the problem here is he's not going to find 10 people. So the angels are entering in chapter 19. Y'all, I know I'm covering a lot of ground here. Stick with me. Chapter 19, the two angels entered Sodom in the evening, as Lot was sitting in Sodom's gateway. It's important to notice where he is. When Lot saw them, he got up to meet them. He bowed with his face to the ground and said, "My lords, turn aside to your servant's house, wash your feet, and spend the night. Then you can get up early and go on your way." Sounds really great, right? He's being hospitable. He's just being a gentleman, welcoming them into his home. "No," they said, "we'd rather spend the night in the square." But he urged them so strongly that they followed him and went into his house. He prepared a feast, baked unleavened bread for them, and they ate. Verse 4, before they went to bed, the men of the city of Sodom, both young and old, the whole population surrounded the house. They called out to Lot and said, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Send them out to us so that we can have sex with them." So maybe you're already picking up on here. This is a reversal of Genesis 6. There we had supernatural beings coming down to sleep with human women. Now we have humans trying to sleep with angelic beings. Sex is a theme throughout all of this. It's no doubt a problem. It's not the core of their issue, though. And we'll see that in just a second. Verse 6, Lot went out to them at the entrance, shut the door behind him. He said, "Don't do this evil, my brothers. Look, I've got two daughters who haven't been intimate with a man. I'll bring them out to you, and you can do whatever you want to them. However, don't do anything to these men, because they've come under the protection of my roof." Whatever that uneasy, gross feeling is that you have as you read and hear that, sit with that. You should be appalled at what you just read. This is not something God is approving of. This is Lot doing something ridiculous in offering up his daughters to the town. This is, I don't know that we honestly have strong enough words to describe what Lot is proposing here. And let me be very clear again. This is not, I don't think we can look to Lot as an example of somebody following after God. If he is, he's not doing it well. From what we know of his life, he's not an example for us. And I know I'm potentially stepping on a hornet's nest here, because this is speculation, but from clues we have in this story about what Sodom and Gomorrah were like, it sure seems like they valued men significantly more than they valued women. That's the only explanation I can come up with as to why Lot would be willing to do this, protect these men, but offer up his own daughters. And everybody that it mentions in the story from Sodom is a man up to this point as well. And I just want to say that that is, again, not what God has in mind. From the beginning and today and for eternity, men and women are equal in God's eyes, and we should be treating them that way as well. Now, do we have differences? Sure. There are so many things that women are more gifted at than men are, and there are things that men are more gifted at than women, and that's a beautiful thing. There's so many things that I watch Rachel do. Like, how does she just know to do that? It's just natural in her. And then she's probably less impressed with me, but there are things that I do naturally that she doesn't do so naturally. And that's good. That's an okay thing. That's good for us to have these differences and to embrace each other within our differences. I just want to make sure I say, as we get to this point in this story, none of you are more or less valuable because of your gender. Please don't ever believe that lie. And I'm going to put it on you guys in the room to make sure this is a place where the ladies that come into this space feel safe and respected and treated like they are a daughter of God. Like, that's on us to set the tone in that way. I need you to take that seriously. Like, that's, if I can do anything about it, that is going to be the case in this ministry. Guys, that's how we have to set the tone for how we treat the women in this ministry. Now, it goes both ways, but I want the men to set the tone in here. Like, ladies should walk in here and be like, "I just feel so loved and respected when these guys don't even know me." That should be what the ladies in this room feel when they walk in, okay? Can we agree on that, guys? Let's make that, yeah. Let that be the reputation that this room has. All right, let's keep moving in the story. We could talk about that for a long, long time. Genesis 19, jump to verse 9. Again, I think it's a man-woman issue because the men don't, like, Lot offers up his daughters, and they're like, no, we want the men. Just a whole, let's keep going. Verse 9, they put pressure on Lot and came up to break down the door. But the angels reached out, brought Lot into the house with them, and shut the door. You see God shutting them in. This is God's messengers protecting them. He's offering their protection again. They struck the men who were at the entrance of the house, both young and old, with blindness so that they were unable to find the entrance. They stop what is happening. So they're really gracious, and they protect Lot and his family, just like they've done for Noah, just like they offered to Cain. But then jump down to the end of the story, verse 24. Then out of the sky, the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah, burning sulfur from the Lord. He demolished these cities, the entire plain, all the inhabitants of the city, and whatever grew on the ground. So this is an awful story with a horrific ending. And accounts like this should cause us to stop and do some self-evaluation. Like if God comes down and he assesses all these situations in the story, then he has a conversation. What would that conversation be like with you? If God came down, assessed your life, and he told you what he finds, what would that conversation be like with you? I want to ask you a few questions to help you think about what the answer to that might be. The first question is very simply this: how do you treat other people? Because that is at the core of what was wrong in Sodom and Gomorrah. How do you treat other people? Did they have a sex problem? Absolutely. We can see that so plainly. They did, and that's a regular way that people get themselves in trouble throughout Scripture. You need to take it seriously. Like, God is not a killjoy by reserving sex for marriage. He is protecting you in that. He's giving you a really good gift and keeping you from harm by reserving that for marriage. Don't think God is trying to keep you from having fun. No, he's trying to let you have joy in that and keep you from harm outside of it. But sex was just a symptom of a deeper issue that these cities had. They had a heart problem with how they treat other people. So inside the city, with people who were citizens there, this is, again, the type reputation they had. They had a really corrupt court system, so they routinely ignored violence and murder. They allowed theft. They implemented bogus charges for services. Apparently there was a ferry service there, and if you took the ferry, it was one price. If you decided to swim across, they charged you four times that for using the water. This is the type of stuff that they come up with. It was said that if someone stabbed you, you should pay them a fee for medically bleeding you. This is the attitude they had towards crime. It's wild, like a completely corrupt court system. That's how they treated their own people, okay? But the outsider, it gets no better with them. It's much, much worse if you're not one of them. Giving to the poor, giving to the needy, it was actually illegal. There were people who were killed for giving to the needy. It was said that they had beds available in the town for the outsiders to come in. Maybe Lot was having a good moment in trying to protect these men from this, but they had essentially hospitality rooms where people could come stay in the town. But if the bed in the room was too long for you, they would put you on the rack and stretch you out, if you're familiar with that torture technique, so that you fit the bed. Or if you were too long for the bed, they would cut your feet off so that you would fit the bed. Like, this is crazy stuff we're talking about here. This is a ridiculous place to be. It begs the question, what in the world is Lot doing here? Why does he stay in this place? The only thing I can come up with is he'd become one of them. This is where he wanted to be. And if you don't believe me that this was, they were totally corrupt and inhospitable, and this was their deeper issue, I want you to see what Ezekiel says about Sodom and Gomorrah. When the word daughters is used in this passage, it's talking about cities, surrounding towns. This is what God, he's saying to the people of God, but he's using Sodom as an example. As I live, the declaration of our Lord God, your sister Sodom and her daughters, the surrounding cities, have not behaved as you and your daughters have. Now, this is very plain for us. This was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, plenty of food, and comfortable security, but didn't support the poor and needy. They were haughty and did detestable acts before me, so I removed them when I saw this. They did not care for people. Sex was one of the symptoms. Man, they had a hospitality issue. had a problem with how they treat people. You got to think there. Only the top of the proverbial food chain actually thrived in a city like this. It's a ridiculously bad reputation that they had. Like, people would have known to avoid Sodom and Gomorrah. So again, begs the question, what in the world is Lot doing there? Brings us to our second question that I want to ask you. What environments do you put yourself in? What kind of environments are you putting yourself in? Maybe this is so easy to pick on at the moment, but you've seen the news the last few days. Tiger Woods, the golfer, he's in a car wreck. He's charged with DUI. This is not the first time this has happened. Since 2009, this is the fourth time he's been in like a significant rollover car crash. And there's alcohol or something involved in all of these scenarios. I don't mean to pick on Tiger Woods. I just want to say, you don't have to be a therapist to realize he's putting himself in the wrong environments. He's putting himself in situations where this is going to happen over and over again. If he would avoid these environments, he could probably avoid the issues that come along with it. Where are you putting yourself? Well, what's Lot doing? If you look back in the story, Lot, man, when he first goes to Sodom, Sodom and Gomorrah get into a war. They get carried off as captives. Thankfully, he's got Uncle Abraham that comes and saves him and brings him back. I think that would be enough for me to think, I need to get back closer to Abraham. I probably should distance myself from Sodom. I would rather not be carried off as a prisoner of war again. Nah, he settles in. He's committed to Sodom for whatever reason. He goes back there. I want you to notice at the beginning, it said he settled near Sodom. But where do we find him in chapter 19? And he's greeting people at the gate. He welcomes them into his home. It's very clearly in the city. He's calling the people of the city brothers. He's been part of this environment so long that he's become one of them. Somewhere along, he was close to it. He probably stepped foot inside it. And just over time, I'm going to guess he became somebody that he didn't think he would. So what types of environments are you putting yourself in where you know you make poor decisions? If you know you need to avoid those things, man, ask somebody to hold you accountable. Ask somebody, say, hey, one of y'all, I'm not calling out any names, you're dating, and this is so responsible, and I'm so proud of you. You had somebody that you're accountable to, that when you're alone, somewhere by yourself, you got somebody that both of you text, say, hey, we're alone right now, I need you to ask me how it goes later. It's beautiful. When you've got environments that you know are potentially trouble for you, either don't go there or you need to put parameters in your life to keep yourself from getting in trouble, okay? Don't find yourself in a place where you're just settling in. Don't get comfortable with whatever that environment is, whatever that city is that you need to avoid. Because you know the place. You know the place that tries to pull you farther from Jesus. You know the environment. You know the person. You know the setting. Don't go there, man. Don't become friends with that environment. Don't settle in. This is your moment tonight to get out, okay? Run, flee. You don't want to end up like Lot did in this situation. Look, I know this is heavy stuff, so my next two questions for you are full of hope, okay? What I want you to see is that Abraham was interceding for this city, right? The question is, who are you interceding for? And if you're a follower of God, and you know people who are far from God, man, are you interceding for them? Who are you interceding for? If you have names that come to mind, but you're not praying on their behalf, you're not asking God to spare them, you're not asking God to intervene in their life so that their life might change and they would be spared from harm, again, let's let tonight be the night where that starts. Abraham's praying for Lot. Look, chapter 19, verse 29. So it was when God destroyed the cities of the plain, what happened to Lot? Why was Lot able to find grace? Because of Abraham. He remembered Abraham and brought Lot out. Lot really had no part in it. He just got Abraham praying on his behalf, and he finds himself out of trouble. There was no righteousness found in the city, right? All he had to do was find 10 people. They didn't find any righteousness in the city, and yet God was gracious to Lot and his family on behalf of Abraham. Would you be that for somebody? Somebody was that for you at some point along the way. Go be that for somebody else. Last question. Who's interceding for you? You say, but wait, I'm not Sodom and Gomorrah. Do I need interceding? Well, yeah, That's what we need to realize tonight. That's how we need to prepare our hearts and our minds for Easter. Like, I know you're not involved in the things Sodom and Gomorrah were, in all likelihood. You're probably nothing like them. And yet, if God came down, assessed your life, had a conversation with you, is he going to find righteousness in you? Thankfully, we have an answer to that question. I'm going to read you several things from the book of Romans that Paul's writing about. Here's, God has assessed your life. It's already happened, whether you realize it or not. God has assessed your life, and here's what he's found. This is Romans chapter 3, starting in verse 10. There is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. All alike have become worthless. There is no one who does what is good, not even one. Why did he not find 10 righteous people in Sodom and Gomorrah? Because there aren't any. There are none. If you walked in here tonight thinking you were righteous, you were wrong. That's not the label that you have. This is not good news. But Paul doubles down just a few verses later, Romans 3:23. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Okay, we clearly need help. We need somebody interceding on our behalf. And thankfully, we have somebody. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 25. Therefore, Jesus is able to save completely those who come to God through him, since he always lives to intercede for them. That is Jesus' role in your relationship with God, your reconciliation between you and God. Jesus is the one interceding for you, and he does so with his life. Why would he do that for you? Because he loves you. Romans 5, verse 8, but God proves his own love for us in that while you were still a sinner, Christ died for us. That's how he proves that he loves you. He sees your situation, he sees your lack of righteousness, and he says, I'll take care of it. You don't have any righteousness, but I have some. I'll give it to you. I'll let you have mine. Praise God he does, right? Because we're in trouble. We just sang it. We're in trouble if this is about our own righteousness. And maybe that feels harsh. I don't know, that we need somebody intervening for us. But I want you to think, no matter how big or small the sin may be in your life, what you got to realize is that what you're being measured up against is perfection. And when sin, if sin is against like me, if you do something to wrong me, well, you know, there's some penalty for that. Like we may have to have a conversation. Who knows? It's not that big of a deal, right? But when you sin against a holy God, the ramifications of that are multiplied infinitely. We need somebody to step in on our behalf to avoid what we earn because of our sin. Romans 6:23, for the wages of sin, which you earn because of your sin, for the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life in Christ Jesus, our Lord. Look, we are really close to celebrating Jesus' resurrection this weekend, and I hope you're looking forward to it. We need to make sure that as we prepare ourselves this week to celebrate that, that we are in a right mindset. I mean, that involves us repenting. So that's what we're going to do with the rest of our night, is we're going to take a moment, and I want you to actually ask God, what do I need to clear the air with between you and me? What is in my life that doesn't need to be there? God, I know it's not, my righteousness is never going to get me back to you. I need you to step in, and I want to honor that by living a life that is as close to holy as I can get. So God, I need you to rid me of whatever it is in my life that does not please you. Because you needed him to step in for you, and the least we could do is try to live for him as a response, right? So we're going to take communion in just a moment. But before we do, I want to give you a few minutes here. I'm going to let it sit, okay? I want you to take a moment. I want you to ask God to reveal sin in your life that you need to confess to him, okay? Take a moment to do that. If you need to take a step further, I know this is going to push you way out of your comfort zone. If you would be willing to, and if you need to, tell somebody. There is power in voicing the sin in your life, in confessing it out loud. I was telling some guys earlier, sometimes it can feel easier to confess sin to God than it can to other people, right? Because he's invisible. We don't have to actually face him face to face, which sounds really strange that it's easier to confess to him than other people. And if you can voice something out loud to another person, they can actually help you. None of us can help you unless you're honest and open about whatever it is going on in your life, okay? Take a moment. Ask God to reveal to you what you need to confess. And then I'm going to walk us through communion in just a moment.